2016 marks Between the Lines' 25th year on the air. As we celebrate our all-volunteer independent media project's anniversary, please consider subscribing to our podcasts and supporting our work. Visit our website at btlonline.org, that's btlonline.org, for details on how to subscribe and make a contribution.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Scott Swenson of Common Cause, who discusses his group's concern about the Supreme Court's recent ruling overturning former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell's conviction on corruption charges. Joshua Prebanek, executive editor of the Public Herald, who talks about his investigation that revealed how government agencies have suppressed public complaints about water contamination linked with fracking. And Andrew Hanauer of the Jubilee USA Network, who assesses the benefits and negative aspects of the Puerto Rico Oversight Management and Economic Stability Act, recently passed by Congress and signed into law by President Obama. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Massive budget cuts in Brazil have grounded police helicopters and parked police cars as local governments are conserving cash on the eve of the August Summer Olympics in Rio de Janeiro. Rio State Governor Francisco Dornelles declared a financial emergency as budgets for public services were slashed and police departments were forced to solicit donations to carry out routine activities. Brazil's economy shrank by 4% last year, hitting Rio hard, all in the midst of the impeachment of the nation's president, Dilma Rousseff, and an anti-corruption probe that has implicated dozens of politicians and corporate executives. According to the Guardian newspaper, public employees, including teachers and doctors, have seen delays in receiving their salaries, provoking protest occupations of schools and hospitals. Yet, Rio plans to deploy 85,000 police officers and soldiers during the three-week Summer Games, double the security mobilization for the 2012 London Olympics. Up to 500,000 foreign tourists are expected in Rio for the Games, in spite of warnings about the Zika virus. Rio's police chief, Fernando Veloso, told O Globo News in a recent interview, "We're at the limit of our operational capacity, and I can't discard the possibility of a collapse." Hours after U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch announced a civil rights investigation into the Chicago Police Department, Chicago Fraternal Order of Police President Dean Angelo flew to Washington, D.C. to meet with officials at the U.S. Department of Justice. The city had recently released a dash cam video of Officer Jason Van Dyke killing 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. Graphic footage showed the officer firing a hail of bullets at the black teen as he walked away. In the wake of McDonald's death, the union has faced growing public scrutiny over its alleged role in shielding his killer. Officer Van Dyke faced 20 civilian complaints over a decade, including accusations of using excessive force. The Obama administration has launched civil rights investigations in cities like Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore, Maryland, the scenes of high-profile police killings. According to In These Times magazine, analysis of past Department of Justice investigations show a mixed record, some revealing a lack of cooperation from police officials and their unions. Many police unions have won protections for rank-and-file officers in their contracts, including authorizing delays in giving statements after a shooting, which may give officers time to confer and get their story straight, and a statute of limitations on disciplinary consequences. In April, the Chicago Police Accountability Task Force observed, "The collective bargaining agreements have essentially turned a code of silence into official policy." But community activists hope the federal investigation into the Chicago Police Department will reassess union rules and promote reforms to increase accountability when police officers kill civilians. On July 1st, Vermont became the first state in the nation to require the labeling of foods containing genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. It is the culmination of years of organizing by food activists in the face of resistance from giant food corporations over what is disclosed on a food label. Many critics of GMOs say genetically engineered foods are neither regulated nor safe and can harm human health in ways that scientists don't fully understand. But now, there's growing concern among GMO labeling advocates that Vermont's historic law would be overturned by a proposed federal law that would deny consumers information on what's in the food they're buying. Politicians introduced federal legislation developed by giant food corporations that the consumers' right community has dubbed Deny Americans the Right to Know, or DARK Act. Vermont is the second smallest state in the nation in terms of population, but a hub for organic farmers and farmers' markets. It is also home to many struggling dairy farmers who rely on GMOs to cut costs and who worry about keeping family farms profitable. Critics complain that the spread of GMOs into industrial monoculture has harmed soil health. There are similar debates about whether GMOs increase pesticide use and ultimately threaten the global food supply. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
In a unanimous decision handed down on June 27th, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the corruption conviction of former Virginia Governor Robert F. McDonnell. In September 2014, a jury unanimously convicted Governor McDonnell and his wife Maureen of public corruption, finding that the couple had used the governor's office to assist Johnny R. Williams Sr., a wealthy dietary supplement company executive, advance his business interests. In exchange, Williams gave the McDonald's $177,000 in loans and gifts, including a Rolex watch, vacations, partial payments for a daughter's wedding reception, and $20,000 in designer clothing and accessories. The Supreme Court decision to vacate the conviction means that the former Republican governor, who was once mentioned as a possible GOP presidential candidate, will not have to serve a 2-year sentence, and his wife will avoid serving her 1-year-and-a-day prison term. In rendering their opinion, the justices stated that instructions to the jury in this case on what constitutes official acts was too broad. The High Court remanded the case back to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit to determine if there is sufficient evidence to justify a new trial. Your reporter spoke with Scott Svensson, Vice President for Communications with Common Cause. Here he discusses the overturning of the McDonald conviction and the dangerous precedent he believes it sets for making it more difficult to prosecute office holders who sell political access and influence to the highest bidder.
It's very clear this is not politics as usual by any stretch of the imagination. There's ample evidence that Governor McDonnell took gifts and loans provided by his friend, Mr. Williams, accepted vacations, a Rolex watch, $20,000 shopping spree, $15,000 in catering expenses for their daughter's wedding, tens of thousands of dollars in private loans in exchange for Governor McDonnell promoting Mr. Williams' product and using the privileges and power that come with the office of the governor of any state, in this case Virginia, to host events and to give the state's official seal of approval to this product and to this business. In one instance, McDonnell emailed Williams asking about a $50,000 loan, and 6 minutes later sent another email to his staff requesting an update on the scientific research surrounding Williams' products. So you see a very clear line between the money coming in or the request for the money and the governor's interest in this case.
Tell our listeners about what the Supreme Court unanimous decision says that threw out the corruption conviction against Bob McDonnell. What was the rationale for the Supreme Court in making this ruling?
It's a little hard to discern. They have been very clear that quid pro quo corruption in every other case is usually what they cite. This is as clear a case of pay-to-play quid pro quo corruption as you could find, and yet they managed to weasel out of this. It's clear we can't rely on federal laws any longer to protect and preserve our democracy, but we're not left empty-handed. We, as organizers and people, need to start to work on small donor campaign finance reform and gift campaign finance laws at the local and state level so that we can demand consistency in our jurisprudence and law for the court, and that we can rid the country of pay-to-pay politics. The president is sitting on an executive order that would deal with this directly on a federal level. In Virginia, Governor McDonnell, other governors of the states have very specific disclosure laws that rule against pay-to-play politics or shine a light on them, so they are it's a prophylactic. It prevents people from wanting to take advantage of the system. Virginia just doesn't have that in place. And so the people of Virginia have to get those laws in place. Other states obviously should be doing the same thing, because right now we've got a court that's playing politics. And if you get, you know, one decision on one day that looks like it's going in one direction, and the very next day you get this decision, which says quid pro quo, we don't see that here, that is a court that is out of balance and out of touch with where the American people are. And we've got to have stricter campaign finance laws to make sure that we can correct for that.
What precedent does this Supreme Court case send to the rest of the country? Many critics have said this is hands down going to make it much more difficult for the government to prove corruption charges against elected officials who take gifts, who accept remuneration for favors given.
Absolutely. And there is no doubt about it. Unless and until this ruling is corrected in terms of the remand of the lower court and vacated by the high court, that they get a different decision from the lower court that can be affirmed, this is sending a signal that pay-to-play politics is alive and well. There are very, very few cases of actual sort of money exchanging hands from one to the other, as we've sometimes seen in sort of grainy video shot by undercover cameras and whatnot in the Abscam trials or other things like that. That sort of corruption, that sort of here's $1 billion that I'm going to give you in a briefcase, and now you're going to do me this favor, that just is pretty far afield from what happens in Washington. What happens, like in the McDonald case, is legal. And it's only different by inches from someone handing over a bag of cash and saying, I want you to do this favor for me or for my business. In this case, no votes. It was still a way of using the official apparatus of the state of Virginia and its scientific and business acumen and authority to lend credence and credibility to this gentleman's product and help him make lots of money. And that is an exchange of money and goods, or money and services, however you want to frame it, that sure seems like it opens the door now with this particular ruling to more rampant pay-to-play politics in the country. The most important thing for your listeners to know tonight is that all is not lost. People are working very hard, smart, thoughtful lawyers across this country, in think tanks and activists around this country, are working very hard to put together reform measures that will ensure democracy remains of, by, and for the people and doesn't get sold out to the highest bidder. We're in a very dark moment in our history right now. There is no question about that.
That was Scott Svensson, Vice President for Communications with Common Cause. Find more commentary and analysis on the McDonald case by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. For the past decade, Pennsylvania has been ground zero for fracking, the industrial fossil fuel extraction process that requires 1 million gallons of water, sand, and hundreds of unknown chemicals for each gas well drilled. Families living near such wells have complained that fracking has contaminated their drinking water, but in most cases, they haven't been able to prove it. A series of investigations by ProPublica, the Center for Public Integrity, Harvard University, and others all revealed problems with Pennsylvania's Department of Environmental Protection's lack of enforcement and follow-through on suspected cases of water contamination linked to fracking. Last fall, Public Herald, a nonprofit investigative news organization based in Pittsburgh, released a report that found 9 different ways the state has kept complaints out of the public record. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Joshua Perbanek, executive editor of the Public Herald, who explains that after a court case was won by another news outlet, he and his partner were able for the first time to get access to 2,300 complaint investigations. The Herald is now calling for a federal investigation of both the Pennsylvania DEP and the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, which in 2015 issued a report stating there was no evidence of a serious problem with the state's drinking water due to fracking. The report, however, did not cite any of the thousands of complaints in making its determination. Here, Joshua Probanek discusses his investigation.
Initially, what tipped us off in the records was not actually something that we were able to find at the department. We had a source who had contacted us about contaminated water. We went out and looked at their case that the department handled, and we were able to get the records from the source because they were delivered to them from the DEP. And when we looked through them, we started to see really serious problems with the DEP's decision-making. For instance, you know, this particular person ended up having a clean pre-drill test. Okay, they had a very clean baseline, no contaminants in their water supply. And then in post-drill, after the drilling happened in, I think it was 2010 or whatnot, they had spikes in arsenic, they had spikes in methane, they ended up having an introduction of radon into their water, so there was a possible contamination of radium-226 or 228, and there was some illegal activity that happened from the company, which the company illegally buried a waste pit on the site, and the department just created a new permit for them so that they didn't have to hold the company accountable and issue any fines or violations. So we had a lot of red flags with this particular case. And when we went to go look at the record for this person in the DEP's office, not a single part related to the water contamination was inside of the record at the department. So that was extremely disturbing for us. Number one, that we could not see those records. Number two, they ended up ruling that this particular person, that the operator was not responsible for contamination to their water supply. And that ruling wasn't based on any kind of scientific decision. That ruling was based on something called the Section 3218 of Chapter 58 of Pennsylvania's Oil and Gas Act. And that states that the company is presumed responsible when the complaint comes in if the complaint is made within 6 months of the drilling being started. However, what that does not mean is that the department automatically can rule a case to be non-impact if a person makes a complaint after 6 months. And that's exactly what they told this person. Oh, we're sorry, you made your complaint after 6 months, therefore we cannot hold the company liable for contamination to your water supply, case closed. So it's a clear misinterpretation of the Pennsylvania law by the Department of Environmental Protection for one reason or another. And as we started to dig through these cases, that particular pattern where they had misinterpreted this law and made that decision, and dismissed pre-drill tests happened again and again and again and again. So it wasn't just this isolated case.
The previous governor, Republican Tom Corbett, was extremely pro-fracking. Joshua Probanek, have you seen any change in the oversight of fracking since Democrat Tom Wolf came in, whom I'm sure appointed his own head of DEP?
Since Wolf took office in 2015, we've scanned and reported on scanned records of water contamination complaints during his time in office, and we've also reported on large plumes of contamination that have happened during his time in office. And to be quite honest with you, we were hopeful that when Wolf took office, we would be able to sit down with the department or sit down with Wolf, explain what we had seen during the Corbett administration, and expect some kind of task force to be created to address the issues and get this dealt with, so people could be vindicated, get cases reopened, get new decisions, new determinations made by the state for these cases. And the secretary, John Quigley, who was the secretary of DEP that was recently resigned, refused to meet with us to discuss the issue in two different occasions. In fact, our experience with this administration at this point, it is not only just the same as it was with the Corbett administration, but getting much worse because they have not reined in, they have not created any accountability for the egregious actions that have been perpetuated by the DEP at this point in their decision-making. I can say that we are up to nearly 15 different patterns that we've discovered how DEP covers up cases, and three of those patterns came from the time when Governor Tom Wolf has been in office.
What would you like to see happen next as a result of your investigation?
We have called for a federal criminal investigation the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection and the U.S. EPA due to the findings that we discovered in our complaint report, our September 2015 complaint report, where we released 9 ways the department covered up water contamination related to drinking water complaints from fracking. And I think that really the only path forward here is to begin a congressional hearing, to bring in the inspectors at the department, to bring in the supervisors at the department, to bring in the administrative staff at the Department of Environmental Protection, the DEP, and also to bring those same people in from the EPA who handled complaint cases in Pennsylvania and who were responsible for the national study that was released.
That was Joshua Prebenik of the Pittsburgh-based Public Herald. Learn more about the Herald's investigation into water contamination linked with fracking by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After months of congressional inaction on Puerto Rico's looming debt crisis, President Obama signed into law the Puerto Rico Oversight, Management, and Economic Stability Act, known by its acronym PROMESA, or Promise in Spanish. The new oversight board was authorized on June 30th, just before a July 1st deadline for the island's government to make a $2 billion payment to creditors that Puerto Rico's governor, Alejandro García Padilla, says they cannot pay. The island defaulted on an earlier payment in May. Although Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory, because it's not a state, the island is not allowed to restructure its daunting $72 billion debt under Chapter 9, the way bankrupt cities like Detroit have done. President Obama and supporters of PROMESA maintain that the measure will provide more stability, better services, and greater prosperity over the long term for the people of Puerto Rico. But many opponents of the PROMESA bill say that Puerto Rico shouldn't pay its debts to enrich Wall Street profiteers. They point to the fact that $33.5 billion of the $72 billion in debt is actually interest on capital appreciation bonds, representing 785% interest on an earlier $4.3 billion loan. Critics also oppose the structure of the oversight board, which would not be accountable to the island government and requires that only one of its 7 members resides or has a business in Puerto Rico. The board will have control over Puerto Rico's future budget, financial plans, and regulations. Your reporter spoke with Andrew Hanauer, Jubilee USA Network's campaigns director, who examines the strengths and weaknesses of the PROMESA legislation and the long-term economic challenges facing the people of Puerto Rico.
$72 billion in debt, about $20,000 per person on the island. So, you know, in Puerto Rico, you have a couple sort of unique factors. One is that, you know, Puerto Rico's, you know, essentially colonial status, which has allowed it to be treated unfairly under U.S. law for a number of years. So that a number of laws imposed on Puerto Rico have negatively impacted both its economy and also its ability to get out of debt. For instance, Puerto Rico is excluded from the same bankruptcy protection that's offered to U.S. states. And the second thing is that Puerto Rico has sort of the unique situation in which its residents, if they decide that there aren't enough economic opportunities in Puerto Rico, they don't need a passport. They just get on an airplane and fly to the United States and the mainland, and they can take up residence there. And so over the last decade, Puerto Rico has lost something like 10% of its population to people leaving mostly for places like Florida and New York. And so the end result is a sort of an economic death spiral where more and more people leave. They're the people who can afford plane tickets. So the tax base is eroded and good professionals in good paying jobs are leaving. And it's negatively impacting the whole island.
Tell us about the recent congressional action addressing Puerto Rico's debt crisis, something called the Puerto Rico Oversight, Management, and Economic Stability Act, or PROMESA. What is PROMESA, and what will it do to help Puerto Rico in assessing the pros and cons of that legislation?
What this bill does is really 2 main things. First, it gives Puerto Rico tools to restructure its debt. So basically, it creates breathing space. It puts a stop on lawsuits from creditors, and it creates a system whereby Puerto Rico can bring, you know, its creditors to the table, negotiate a solution, and then make sure that that solution happens and basically force what we would call vulture funds or holdout creditors to agree to that solution, even if they don't want to. If in other words, if the majority of creditors agree to a deal, then you can't have holdouts. Everyone has to agree to it. The second thing it does, which is, you know, certainly controversial, is it creates an oversight board. And this oversight board has the ability to review budgets passed by Puerto Rico and has some ability to, you know, make decisions around those budgets and Puerto Rico's decisions, finances. We don't necessarily think that's the answer to Puerto Rico's problems, and I think we certainly have a lot of concern about Puerto Rico's colonial status. I think this bill overall, though, was absolutely necessary to stave off a significant economic collapse because Puerto Rico defaulted on its debt just this past Friday. And if it didn't have these tools in place, we would have seen, I think, very serious consequences.
One of the provisions, I believe, is that this oversight board really only has to have one person on it who is Puerto Rican themselves, who lives in Puerto Rico. That means, to some critics, that Puerto Rico itself won't be well represented on this board, and any kind of local control is extremely in jeopardy.
Yeah, absolutely. And we agree with those critics. We have pushed, since this bill was introduced, to change that. We would like to see Puerto Ricans on this board. You know, if this board is going to exist, we want it to be as democratic as possible and to respect Puerto Rico's democracy as much as possible. So, you know, that's certainly a problem, and we agree with that. This bill is very flawed. It has flaws. Just like any bill that is, you know, a bipartisan compromise, you're going to have provisions that both sides have problems with. But this bill does a lot of really, really good things. And I think in the end, the question was, is there an alternative? The answer was no, there was no alternative. So, you know, we believe that passing this bill was necessary to deal with Puerto Rico's debt crisis, which is the most immediate short-term concern. And I think now the question is, who will be on this oversight board? How will Puerto Rico be represented on this oversight board? And how do we move forward so that we can address Puerto Rico's status and really begin to long-term create an economic structure that's going to benefit Puerto Rico's people?
That was Andrew Hanauer, Jubilee USA Network's campaigns director. Find more perspectives on Puerto Rico's debt crisis and the PROMESA plan by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.